Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. It's always cocktail time in New Orleans, but when Ann Tunerman works her magic with Tales of the Cocktail, things really ramp up. On this week's show, Ann tells tales about the annual week-long event, now widely recognized as the number one international cocktail gathering. Then, restaurateur Dickie Brennan and Leidenheimer Baking Company's Sandy Wan discuss the inspiration behind an old traditional loaf of bread you've probably never tasted before. So let's all raise a glass and propose a toast to this week's Louisiana Eats. Ann Tunerman, founder of the phenomena that is Tales of the Cocktail, dominates the world of cocktail culture in a way that really has never been done before. Ann, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you very much. I'm excited. This is my first time on your show.
So you're a New Orleans-born, bred, and educated girl, huh?
Yes, I'm actually very proud. I'm public school educated. Everything from elementary school all the way to went to Abramson High School and graduated from UNO a long time ago. But yes, with a degree in marketing.
A degree in marketing. Mm-hmm. That was one thing I was curious about. And so with your newly minted degree in marketing, what did you set out originally to do?
With my degree, I was always interested in advertising and promotions. My very first job out of college, making $13,000 a year, I worked at an ad agency that only handled motion picture accounts. Mm. We were on Royal Street, third floor of a little building. And then really I found my footing working in radio and television promotions. But I always kind of had an entrepreneurial spirit and would do, you know, some of my own things on the side. And really through those relationships, like in television, I started working with spirits companies and then started my walking tour. And it's just all evolved into Tales of the Cocktail.
So you had a cocktail walking tour that you developed.
Right.
How long ago was that?
That was 12 years ago now, because that was the premise of Tales of the Cocktail. What happened at the time was I was really inspired by the book Obituary Cocktail, mm-hmm. and started thinking that there was nothing that told our history of dining and drinking and all the famous drinks invented here, all the famous spirits invented here. So put together this walking tour that still takes place today and took people behind the scenes at, you know, Antoine's, Arnaud's, Toujac's, you know, Napoleon House, told them about all these famous places. And to celebrate the first anniversary of that tour, put together Tales of the Cocktail, which that first year, my husband likes to say, we had two events, an opening and closing event, with about 50 people to 100 in the Monteleon Carousel Bar.
And that was 11 years ago this year,
yes,
correct?
11 years ago this year.
So this July, you're going to be hosting the 11th annual Tales of the Cocktail. And
yes.
For someone who has never attended Tales, what can they expect?
We call those people Tales virgins. They can expect a lot. Honestly, usually when people come for the first time, they're a little bit overwhelmed.
Uh-huh.
I think the key is to literally take it one sip at a time. What we advise people to do is, if you're coming for the whole event, pick a few things that are must attends that you definitely want to go to and purchase tickets to. Then leave yourself some free time to visit tasting rooms and some of the other things that you can mingle around. But what I really want to tell the local people, because we have such a vibrant hospitality industry, is, you know, if you're a bar back, a sous chef, a farmer, just come to one thing if you haven't been. I mean, for example, this year we have a seminar on how to grow your own bar garden. That could be of interest to, again, somebody in the kitchen or somebody in the bar.
Absolutely.
But I still feel like we have a lot of local people in the industry. They've heard of Tales of the Cocktail. They don't know exactly what it is. They don't know how to do it, like how to navigate it. So, you know, they either need a Tales veteran like you taking them under their wing and showing them around.
It's hard work, Anne. It's really hard work. Well, in the 11 years, how have you seen the festival evolve?
It's evolved But yet, in some ways, I think it stayed the same. My focus has always been to, despite the growth, have it feel the same.
Mm-hmm.
I want it to have the same feeling. So I want it to be, you know, sophisticated, but relaxed and fun. And it's really grown with the input of the industry. My husband says, and this is really our philosophy, it's the industry's event, we just organize it.
Yeah.
So we have a presenters committee that helps us determine all the seminars. We have committees for our awards. We have committees for our cocktail apprentices. So we're constantly getting their feedback and saying, hey, what should we tweak, evolve, change, update? So I think we've evolved together over the years.
Well, from my perspective, it's one of the most incredible learning opportunities that's offered in New Orleans for people who work in or just enjoy the pleasures of the hospitality industry here. So tell us a little bit specifically about some of the people who present during Tales.
The history is really a big focus because education is our number one element of Tales the Cocktail. We want everybody to be having a good time, but they're there first and foremost to learn. So this year we have 59 seminars, of which we had about 300 to 350 submissions. So again, they're the top people in the world. They're the top, you know, historians. They're the top female master blenders of a Scotch company coming over. So they are really the best of the best, and they understand that these are their peers in the room. I mean, you've said in enough seminars, you know, these people ask very detailed questions, very sciencey, very geeky. But the history is so crucial because I think you have to know the classics before you move on to anything else. So you really have to have a good basics of the classic cocktails, and then you become creative from that. You start making interpretations of those classics or adding contemporary ingredients or doing something else. But I think it's really important that you know those. Those topics always seem to be kind of at the forefront of a lot of the seminars.
Well, it's also really an incredible research incubator for new brands, for people looking for new trends and ideas. How do you nurture that? Because you're doing it.
Well, that's one of the things I think that's important about keeping that feel, because one thing I learned over the years, and this didn't hit me till about 2006, and somebody told me, they said, hey, like, you're making things happen. And it's like, well, how? Just bringing people together. Because what happens is, by having that feel that I'm really particular about, everybody becomes on the same level. So you could be talking to, you know, a brand new bartender, but you want to learn just as much from him as he wants to learn from you. So everybody becomes on the same level. And I think bartenders are so great about sharing information. Even things like the idea of the Museum of the American Cocktail came about from those people meeting that didn't know each other and talking at Tales of the Cocktail. We actually have a funny button we're giving out this year that says, I met my true love at Tales of the Cocktail. We've had so many marriages now. We've had babies. But yes, we've had people go into business together. People get new distributors. People come up with flavors. You know, all kinds of things. Because I think when you just put all those people together, something's bound to happen. And New Orleans also helps with that a lot, because with the French Quarter being relatively confined, it's not like if we were hosting this event in Dallas. Nothing is closed. You can't force any, like, collaboration.
Yeah.
I mean, I tell people, if they literally just showed up and sat in the Monteleone bar, they could do business.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you just sit there and don't move, you can make a sale.
So tell me, Anne, over time, how have you seen the profile of your attendees change?
It's been interesting because we curate the event for the professional bartender. So those are the topics. And we don't have anything that is, say, setting up your, you know, home bar 101. So it's not consumer focused, but yet I say we welcome that hardcore cocktail enthusiast that's just like the foodie, the person that studies wine. They're the ones that, you know, they read Dale DeGroff's book. They read Jim Meehan's book. They're really into it. And those two groups make for really good energy, because the Dales are excited that the cocktail enthusiasts are so excited to meet him, have his book signed, talk to him, go to his spirited dinner. But we're still mainly an industry event. That's the core of what we do. I think what's been exciting in the last few years is we've seen more people outside of craft cocktail bars come.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Ruth's Chris has a woman who has just done a phenomenal job as a beverage director there. Last year, she brought 16 bartenders. it's well worth the investment because they honestly have, like, you know, epiphany moments at Tales of Cocktail.
Yes.
And then they are so, like, on board with her after that. But I'm really excited because when I see Carnival Cruise Line sending people, when I see the Fountain Blue Hotel in Miami sending people, the great thing is that means we're all going to be able to have a better mint julep.
Yes.
You know, down the road, a better Manhattan, a better Rusty Nail. Everybody doesn't need to be making their own bitters, but they can all be making well-made cocktails. So to me, that's exciting.
When we come back, Ann Tunerman explains how Tales of the Cocktail has evolved into a true educational opportunity for aspiring bar chefs. Stay tuned. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. As our conversation with Ann Tunerman continues, Ann explains why aspiring bartenders from all over the world travel to Tales of the Cocktail to participate in the unique educational experience of a Tales apprenticeship.
What's happened over the years of Tales of the Cocktail is now there are a lot more educational opportunities for bartenders. I mean,
yeah.
That's a lot of what we use our funds for, is awarding scholarships for bartenders to go to the bar course in New York, to go to our own bartending schools here, to take a sommelier course, anything like that. But before, there was no formal education process. You basically learned on the job, and hopefully you had a mentor that kind of took you under your wing. Now, that's equally as important, but there are classes, there are schools, and we want to really continue to nurture those things, and they're kind of starting to be a benchmark. If you've taken Bar Smarts, which is a Pernod Ricard class they offer that's going to be at Tales this year, that's one step. If you've taken the bar course in New York, that's another. The CIA now has some more focus even on beverage courses.
You made a reference to having a mentor, and of course, every apprentice needs a mentor. And
mm-hmm.
I know you could not put Tales on
right, that is
without
true.
Your apprentice program. So who are the apprentices, and what do they do during Tales?
The apprentices are really like the soul of Tales of the Cocktail. We started the program in 2006, and it really started as a way to help bartenders get to Tales that wanted to come, and then help us with the back of the house that we needed. And now it is pretty much like one of the most recognizable things you could put on your resume. This year we'll have 70 apprentices. They apply for the job. We have one coming from Tel Aviv. I mean, they literally come from around the world. New Zealand. We have two from New Orleans this year. And again, we have a committee that picks them. And they come and help us execute the event, make all the drinks, everything else. And so they work alongside a lot of the people that are their mentors, preparing their drinks and their syrups and helping
juicing,
with their...
They're muddling.
Right, with their seminars.
They're
yes.
batching.
We have a whole juicing team. And then they can apply for scholarships after the event. We have classes for them at night on a lot of things that are everything from public speaking to reading P&Ls. So it's all about fostering their career. And once you're an apprentice, you're in this ultimate fraternity. And then everywhere we go, like we were just in Buenos Aires, we had four apprentices from that part of the world that worked with us. And
well,
you know,
we're gonna go to Buenos Aires
go,
in a little while. But I wanted to start with, last year, when you hit the 10-year mark, you decided to take Tales on the road. And
mm-hmm.
the first stop was Vancouver in 2012.
Yes.
Why Vancouver?
A lot of it is gut. I mean, I have certain things that I'm looking for in a city, but Vancouver has a really wonderful cocktail culture.
Boy, it does.
Very much a global city. It had people that, you know, were not getting enough recognition there that we thought. Because what happens in these cities is, like, Toronto gets more attention because it's higher volume. But then, like, Vancouver is really where the dining and drinking and the cocktail culture is happening. But on a much bigger scale, it reminded me a lot of New Orleans, and so did actually Buenos Aires. Very passionate people, global cuisine, people from all over the world go there, very friendly. We had people that had been to Tales of the Cocktail from Canada, so they were a little bit familiar with what we were about. And Vancouver was wonderful, so we went there for 2 years, and it's such a great city and great people.
So the Cocktailians of Vancouver, they're all about Tales, huh?
Yes. You know, what's really been a benefit of those events, and we didn't know it at the time, when we say we're going someplace, the best thing about it is it puts a spotlight on that city.
Yes.
Because everybody else asks the same question you did, like, why Vancouver? They're like, why not Seattle? Why not Toronto? Why not Portland? Other people go say, hey, if they're coming here, something must be happening. I mean, we have bartenders there now that were apprentices with us. They've just gotten a lot of attention. One company, they have their own line of bitters sold all over the world called Kayla Nori Bitters. So it afforded them a lot of opportunities and got them a lot of attention as well.
So now let's go. We've been north of the border. Now let's go south of the border. And you went to Buenos Aires. Now, how did that one come about?
That kind of came about the same way. Nobody makes their way through Buenos Aires. If a brand is doing something, they're going to go to London, Paris, New York. I mean, it's the same in the States. New York, San Francisco, Chicago. It's like the rest of the world doesn't exist. So I wanted to go someplace in South America or Latin America. And again, they have a definite joie de vivre, a love of food and dining and drinking, and a really up-and-coming cocktail scene there. But what was interesting in that city is that I think we recognized that even before the brands. I mean, we're meeting with brands, and they're like, why are you coming here? One guy told me after the event who worked for a brand, he said, I didn't think anybody was going to show up. And I mean, I was panicked, would they get up to be there at 10:30? Because these are late night people.
Right.
But they were, and it was amazing. I mean, the event sold out. All the bartenders were listening intently. Nobody got up and left a seminar. We had translators for everything. But it was really phenomenal. And again, it put a spotlight on them, too, because right now people say, well, why not Brazil? But that's more of like flair mixology, where this is more cocktail culture. And Vancouver and Buenos Aires, it's amazing how talented they are because they do not have the resources we do. You know, Buenos Aires, they only have Angostura bitters. You know, I bring them Peixos, the gift, and they're like, you know, happy out their mind. And, you know, we could get that at, you know, Rouse's.
Right.
You know.
So what did you drink down in Buenos Aires that was new and a surprise to you?
My favorite drink in Buenos Aires was a Chinar julep. They drink a lot of bitter spirits.
Yeah.
All the Italians that descended on there after the war, again, it's a wonderful like melting pot of nationalities there. But because of that, they drink more Fernet than any other spirit combined. They actually drink a lot of champagne, a lot of scotch. But the Chinar julep was my favorite. But the bars are all, you know, really great, all very well done, all have different personalities. Really a great group of people down there.
So what's your next frontier?
Well, actually, each of these cities we go to for 2 years. So we'll go to Buenos Aires again in 2014, and then we'll move on from there. So I have a few rolling around in my head right now, but nothing definite yet. So we'll have to announce that next year. We'll come back on the show.
That's the deal. I can't wait to see what's coming out of your head next. Mm-hmm. And this year at Tales, personally, which of this year's events are you the most excited about?
Oh my gosh. Well, I'm excited about executing all of them. But really, there's so much good stuff. When people call the office, they're like, which seminar should I go to? I mean, really. It's kind of like when people call me and somebody asks me this today. If somebody comes to town in New Orleans, what restaurant do you take them to?
Oh.
I mean, 50? You know, it's like, I can't, it's like, what type of food? What part of town? You know?
Yeah, exactly.
There's so much good stuff. So at least if they call and say, okay, I'm deciding on these like three seminars.
Help. Yeah.
You know, then it's like, okay, but you got to help me, you know, narrow down and then find out what they're interested in as well, too.
Job well done, Anne.
Well, thank you.
I'm so happy.
I look forward
to
see what you're attending this year. So.
Oh, I can't wait. So I'll see you in the lounge.
Yes, I'll see you at the bar.
Absolutely. Anne Tunerman, founder of Tales of the Cocktail. During his many years in New Orleans, Tennessee Williams' daily dining routine began with a mid-afternoon Brandy Alexander, followed by a poor boy sandwich. In the hot Louisiana summer, what sounds better than a chilled, stemmed martini glass filled with icy, sweet, creamy liquid? When was the last time you had a Brandy Alexander? Have you ever had one? I remember my first. It was served in the pink light of Flamingo's Cafe on St. Charles Avenue. The Flamingo's version had a frothy top adorned with just the perfect amount of freshly grated nutmeg. Legend has it that that chocolatey drink, perhaps the first chocolate martini, was invented on the occasion of a British royal wedding in 1922. It's said to have been based on a drink called the Alexander that, much like a martini, was a gin-based drink. A Brandy Alexander is an eye-opener at brunch and equally delicious after dinner, especially if you make it with vanilla ice cream. Here's the basic how-to. In a cocktail shaker, combine 1.5 ounces of brandy with 1 ounce of dark creme de coco and 2 ounces of heavy cream. Add ice and shake vigorously for about a minute. Strain into a tall-stemmed cocktail glass and top with just a bit of freshly grated nutmeg. It's a delicious way to beat the heat in the summertime. Here's to you, Tennessee Williams. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats.
He's my Brandy Alexander, always gets me into trouble, but that's another matter. Brandy Alexander, he's my Brandy Alexander, always gets me into trouble, but that's another matter.
I just love to talk food with Chef Ryan Hughes. Whenever Ryan comes to visit us here at Louisiana Eats, he always has some new ideas that he brings to our table. So, Ryan, what's on the menu today?
Pickle juice.
Pickle juice. Pickle juice.
Pickle juice.
What are you going to do with pickle juice?
What do you do with pickle juice? There's so many things you can do with pickle juice, Poppy. Something I learned from an old New Orleans chef who is famous for his fried chicken. You take your chicken, you cut it into sixths, then you take your pieces and marinate it or soak it overnight in pickle juice.
Wow.
Yeah, it's
pickle
perfect.
Juice only.
Pickle juice only.
So how long do you marinate?
You can do, that's always a great question. A lot of people tend to overdo it, so you don't want to do it more than a day because
yeah.
of the brine and the vinegar will actually start to cook the chicken, which you don't want.
So either in the morning you do it
sure.
or you do it overnight if you're making plans for the next day.
If you're doing it and you want to get a little bit of head start, it's perfectly okay to take your chicken and cut it up and then put it in the pickle juice overnight.
And so go ahead and you may as well just tell us the rest of the secret. So how do you make the best fried chicken?
That's the number one question, right?
Yeah.
You know, especially down here in the South.
Exactly. Black iron skillet important.
Black cast iron skillet. Okay, so from the beginning, I do my pickle juice technique now. I usually try to do it. I started at the night before, let it go overnight. Then what I do is I take it out of the pickle juice and I put it on a rack and then stick it in the refrigerator and kind of let it dry a
mm-hmm.
little bit because I want a little dry on the outside. It doesn't overpower things too much. Some people take the pickle juice and wash it off, either or. It doesn't really matter. Then I'll take buttermilk with some eggs and a little bit of hot sauce. I use Crystal hot sauce or
mm-hmm.
you can use Tabasco or whatnot. Mix it all up together. Take your chicken pieces, dip it really quick into the buttermilk mixture. Then I take a Ziploc bag, put the flour with the cornmeal mixture in it, shake it up, and then I add your seasonings to it, cayenne, a little bit of paprika, dried thyme, dried basil, salt, and pepper. And then actually what my secret is with it is after you put it into the plastic bag and you shake it, I put it back into the refrigerator on the same wire rack and let it sit there for at least 2 hours. And when it gets cold like that, the batter mixture kind of forms a shell on it. And then goes into the oil. And so another
now,
way, go
in
ahead.
The oil. Okay, so we've got the black iron skillet. What's the depth of the oil?
I want maybe about a half inch of the chicken showing up off the top.
And what's your approximate temperature that you're going to heat that oil to before you put the chicken in?
I prefer a little bit lower, 350 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have a thermometer, what do, Poppy?
Well, you can put a blue tip kitchen match in it and it ignites.
Ooh, I like that. That's a really
great
idea.
That's a good one. What else do you do?
What you learn from the Chinese is they do it with their woks, and it's fascinating. And you could do this with a chopstick, a wooden chopstick, or if you have a wooden spoon. You heat up your oil, and when you think that the oil is ready, you take your chopstick or your wooden spoon and you put it in the oil. And if you see little bubbles start to come around the side of it, your oil is going to be exactly between 350 to 360 degrees.
That's a great trick.
If it doesn't bubble enough around the side, it's not hot enough. And if your oil is smoking, then obviously it's too much. You need to turn it down.
Yeah, the chicken's not going to, it's going to get too cooked too quick on the outside. Now, it's my opinion that one of the big mistakes that people make next, they're not brave enough to let that chicken properly brown on one side before they turn it over and brown it on the other. And they compensate by turning the chicken again and again.
What I always tell
people is that's your fatal mistake with fried chicken, because every time you turn it in that oil, it's just soaking up some more grease.
It just soaks up grease. You're absolutely right on that. And so people, they freak out. They think that, oh my gosh, I'm going to burn my chicken. So they get over and they hover over it, and there's one person turning it, and then somebody walks by and they turn it again over and over again. But you're absolutely right. And it's the same techniques that we use as professional chefs. The sugars that caramelize on the other side when it's touching the bottom of that cast iron pan, you want that for the crispness. And what that does is it, like you're saying, it seals in the breading and the crispy skin on there. And you want that to be sealed. If you keep on turning it, it doesn't seal it properly, and it just kind of soaks up the rest of that oil.
Okay, I'm ready for some chicken.
Me too.
Thank you, Ryan. Come back soon, okay?
Thanks so much, Poppy. I'd love to.
Chef Ryan Hughes, our Louisiana Eats culinary consultant. Dale DeGroff is undeniably the international king of cocktails. Over 25 years ago at New York's Rainbow Room, Dale pioneered the craft cocktail movement by recreating classic cocktails using authentic, often handcrafted ingredients, and the bar chef was born. In 2004, Dale founded the Museum of the American Cocktail, which is located in New Orleans' Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Dale, what a treat to welcome you back to Louisiana Eats.
I'm really happy to be here. Thank you very much for the invitation. And any day spent in New Orleans is a good day.
Well, tell us about the Museum of the American Cocktail.
Well, one day we're rattling around the house, and I got boxes and shelves full of stuff, and Jill said, maybe if we were to start a museum, we can get rid of all this crap.
There you go.
And that was her idea, I swear to God. No, it was actually a group, my wife and I, and we contacted Anastasia and Jared Miller. They were very interested. They were our second two founders. And then we went to a man who had started drinkboy.com, Robert Hess, who's actually a Microsoft executive, who's a avocation as the cocktail. And then we went to Ted, because Ted was the only person who had a collection that we thought would be large enough to seed this museum.
Well, that answers the question about where all of those incredible artifacts come from. Any other places?
Some are mine, yeah. I mean, like, for example, that 1700s Complete Distiller, which is an extraordinarily rare book, the book that George Washington and Thomas Jefferson used, is mine. But lots of the stuff is Doc's, too. And we have, by the way, given Doc a $5,000 a year massive acquisition budget. He has found so much cool stuff over the last few years with that small acquisition budget. So we now have a lot of stuff we have no place to put. And we're hoping for a bigger space to do that.
Well, tell me about some of the other rare artifacts. What are some of your favorite things in the exhibit?
The Jerry Thomas 1862. There are two of those in the collection, and he's considered to be the father of the profession, and his book, How to Mix Drinks, or The Bon Vivant's Companion, is just the most extraordinary volume and probably very rare and hard to find these days. The one thing that's probably irreplaceable that you can never find and Doc brought to the museum was all these 19th and early 20th century full unopened bottles of spirits. First of all, the 19th century didn't even do much commercial bottling, because you'd buy in the barrel. So it's very rare to find stuff that was bottled, actually bottled. So that's extraordinary.
How did they survive Prohibition?
There was nothing in Prohibition that required you to break the bottles in your own home or in your own cellar.
I see.
People had very deep cellars. Some of them were not discovered until years after Prohibition. People would die or whatever. But there was a lot of stuff out there. And, of course, there was a lot of real legitimate stuff coming into this country during Prohibition, as we all know, if you could afford to buy it.
Yes.
Because not everybody experienced Prohibition quite the same way. I think if you were in a state house somewhere around the country, or if you happened to be a member of the Princeton Club or the Yale Club, you probably didn't experience Prohibition exactly the same way regular folks did.
Why is the museum located in New Orleans?
Where else? I mean, come on. This is an intact neighborhood, the French Quarter, where we started out in the Pharmacy Museum on the second and third floor. It's an intact, not 19th century, 18th century neighborhood, and it's extraordinary. And it has such a long and rich alcoholic beverage traditions that are unmatchable anywhere else in the country. If we were to do it one other place, I guess it would be New York, because New York has that same, you know, long tradition. But New Orleans just seemed absolutely to be the right place, because it is a town where hospitality exists on a level that nowhere else can be matched, in my opinion.
Tales of the Cocktail is the international cocktail event that happens here in New Orleans every July. Could you describe it?
Well, you know, it's because I was there at the beginning from the first one, which, by the way, was a Southern Comfort. It was a Southern Comfort promotion is how it started. And when Katrina happened, Brown-Forman did not want to continue that tradition. So Ann continued it as a generic cocktail.
Ann Tunerman, of course.
Festival. Ann Tunerman and her soon-to-be husband, Paul.
Oh.
But and if you don't understand the background of what was happening in the cocktail world, it's hard to understand what Tales is all about, because there's been a change in a sense, in how bartenders and the bar world is proceeding from what it had over the previous 50 to 70 years since Prohibition. Prohibition did a number on my profession of bartending, and the profession slipped into disrepair, on the rocks, so to speak. And what happened was, maybe at the highest level in some very fine hotels, you had some sort of good beverage service in terms of classic cocktails. But of course, Prohibition had destroyed a lot. It had destroyed a lot of the products. It had turned over the control of alcoholic beverages to the absolute local level, states and counties, which meant that in many states, the raw materials of the cocktail were not even available.
Mm-hmm.
So the cocktail fell into disuse also. There was no skilled labor. There were no products. A lot of the products disappeared. So what happened was, we ended up drinking highballs, rocks drinks, you know, and, mm-hmm. and it sort of spiraled down until the 70s and 80s. We were drinking sea breezes and scotch in the rocks and that type of thing. But with the culinary explosion, which you had so much to do with, that happened in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, America fell in love with big flavor. America fell in love with real and honest ingredient. America fell in love with ingredients from around the world. Because when I'm 64, and when we went to the grocery store, when I was a kid, it was iceberg lettuce, meat and potatoes and gravy, and that was the shot. If you wanted to have something ethnic to eat out, it was probably Italo-American or Cantonese. It's extraordinary where we've come. And you know what? This huge audience that has grown around the culinary side of our business would walk now into a bar and order a margarita, and the guy would push a button.
Yeah.
And this green stuff would come out. And they'd say, wait a minute. Why can't we have real lime juice in our margarita? Isn't that a concept?
Isn't that a shock?
So what happened is, there was a lot of pressure. And people like me, with Joe Baum pushing me, because Joe was the genius and the mentor behind me, behind Kevin Sraley, behind Alice Waters, behind so many people. Joe was the guy who inspired all of us, you know, to go this route. And the route he inspired me to go was, he wanted a classic, no-nonsense, real ingredient, no soda guns, no artificial ingredients kind of bar. And that's what I presented for him in 1985 at a little restaurant called Aurora. Didn't realize he had a 5-year plan for the Rainbow Room.
So, Dale, what do you predict the next big trend in cocktails will be?
Well, there's a couple. One of them is to take all this really elegant, very culinary-driven style of drink and introduce it to a wider market. And one of the reasons why I'm here in New Orleans to begin with is for this thing called the Cheers Conference, this particular visit. And what that has always been is a gathering of corporate beverage managers, just the guys I want to sell this idea to, that yes, indeed, you can have fresh juice in a multi-unit operation. There are ways to do it. Look what they've done on the food side. There are mid to upscale massive chains that have figured out how to get olive oil from Italy, you know, Reggiano from Italy. Why? Because they've opened up lines of distribution. Well, why can't we do that with lemons and limes so we could have a real margarita or whiskey sour at our bars? I'm sure they can. They just haven't thought it out yet. For example, you go to a restaurant and you might have on one single plate a piece of fish from Australia cooked in butter from France with some black sea salt from Hawaii with a little yuzu from Japan, and you're telling me I can't have a fresh lime in my margarita?
Amen. That's you know, the truth.
It's crazy. So that's where we need to go.
If someone is interested in becoming a bar chef, how do you acquire these skills?
Okay, this is trend number two, actually. Back to your trend question.
Yes.
Because the reason I wrote The Craft of the Cocktail is because there was nothing. There was nothing. I learned on the job mostly bad information. I was using sour mix out of a gun. I had no clue what a fresh cocktail was. So now what's happening is we have a growing community of professionals, and there are no great schools. And so I've, with some partners, created something called Beverage Alcohol Resource, where we have designed an interactive online thing called Bar Smarts for the Pernod Ricard company, which is educating thousands of bartenders online.
Cool.
Yeah, it's really a good thing. And there's all these initiatives now. There's another one called Experience Cognac, where you take a test online. And if you win, you go to France. You know what I mean? And to Cognac.
So how do you find that online?
ExperienceCognac.com and BeverageAlcoholResource.com. And these are educational opportunities for young bartenders that simply did not exist before and are starting to grow. There's lots of different initiatives, finally. Most of them driven by big spirits companies because they have the money to do it and the reason to do it. Pernod Ricard has actually put their money where their mouth is and really let us evolve and create a really wonderful and very complex interactive online program, which really cost a lot of money to build. And thank God they were willing to fund it.
Wow, that's really great information. I want to thank you so much again for coming to visit with us. And please come back soon.
All the time. Are you kidding? Jill and I want to live here.
Oh, well, come on. King of the Cocktail, Dale DeGraw. When we come back, restaurateur Dickie Brennan and Leidenheimer Baking Company Sandy Wan explain the historical significance of a simple loaf of bread. You don't want to miss this one. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's hero originally hailed from the island of Saint-Domingue, today's Haiti. In the early 1800s, he dispensed good medicine from his apothecary shop on Royal Street in New Orleans' French Quarter. There, he would mix together French brandy with a special concoction that became known as bitters. Served in an egg cup called a coquetier that resembled today's double-sided jigger, this remedy for whatever ailed you evolved into what is known today as the Sazerac cocktail. That's why the father of the cocktail, Antoine Amédée Peychaud, is this week's culinary heritage hero, recognized with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchens. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. of Leidenheimer Baking Company and Dickie Brennan of New Orleans restaurant fame are old personal friends. Recently, Dickie challenged Sandy to look back into the old Leidenheimer historical files and resurrect the French bread that might have existed in New Orleans before the now ubiquitous poor boy loaf. Gentlemen, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you, Poppy.
Okay, Dickie, how'd you come up with this idea in the first place?
Being the long-term admirer of Sandy Wine and what he creates every day, I knew if anyone had the ability to create something special, it would be Sandy and Leidenheimer Baking Company. So it was a challenge, and I tell you, he sure met it.
So it was kind of like a throwdown. So Sandy, okay, he throws down the sword, and then what happens?
Well, all of our research showed that in the early days of New Orleans, what the bakers were producing were large loaves, in some cases round, but in many cases more pointed loaves. And these were loaves up to 4 and 5 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
These were huge. And we knew that we would have to go back, research the process that was involved in making that product, because we needed a product that could be served at room temperature and yet still maintain a good, healthy crust with a lot of texture, as well as a soft interior that would retain moisture over time.
Dickie, Sandy mentioned this room temperature thing. Why was that so important?
You know, my first reaction with room temperature, typically we love to travel. And mm-hmm. when we travel, it's to eat, it's to see what's going on around the world. And, you know, all the wonderful opportunities I've had to dine in Europe or in New York, Chicago, I've never had bread that was heated. It's actually, you know, something that we do in some of the restaurants in New Orleans. But I'd say in general, around the world, it's just great handcrafted artisan-style breads that you would find in a nice dining experience. So our family's always been proud that in our city, we have one of the greatest American cuisines. It's very well defined, and it's because of our history. And Sandy is so well organized, I just thought he would love to do some research and have a project and be a part of this history.
Sandy, how long did the trial and error process go on for?
Well, what was fortunate for us is that Dickie and his chefs told us about this well in advance of the opening of Tableau. And that offered us the opportunity to not only do the research, but also do some trial and error. We made a few loaves in the beginning, but when I thought we finally had something that was worth showing them, we began to head over to the restaurants and show Chef Ben Thibodeau and Dickie and some of the others over there what we were thinking about, and they seemed to like the idea. So this bread, we knew, needed to be at its best at room temperature. And so what it involved was aging the dough longer than we normally age our own traditional French bread dough. And what that does is it helped to create the thickness in the crust mm-hmm. that gives it a very unique texture, similar to what we would have experienced at the turn of the century, as well as protecting the interior and keeping it soft and moist.
That is so fascinating. So surely this bread had to have a special name. Does it have one?
Well, it does, actually. After all of the research and the work that we did with Dickie and his staff, we decided to name it the Tableauve, in honor of all the wonderful work that Dickie and all of his folks have done to help preserve Le Petit Theater and such an important cultural asset for the city.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, Sandy, I've got a serious request for you.
Uh-oh.
What about cat bread? You know, I've been doing a lot of research recently. I'm like up to my ears in the Two Jacks cookbook research I'm doing. Basically, I've got this incredible kind of a snapshot from 1856 through today. And sometime, as best as I can track it, it seems to be sometime in the 60s or 70s, the cat bread disappeared. So explain what it is.
Well, I'll let you in on a little secret, Poppy.
What?
We still make it.
Well, who's buying it?
I can't tell you. But I can tell you.
Is it this another exclusive arrangement?
It's not completely exclusive, but it's partially exclusive, if that makes any sense. I will tell you this. There are probably a couple of reasons you don't see cat bread on tables anymore. First off, it's an extremely extremely labor-intensive loaf of bread to make. It involves at least three different shaping stages, all of which has to be done by hand. Mm. And it has to be allowed to rest at certain points between those stages. It is a very labor-intensive product to make. The other thing is that the size of it, it's a big piece of bread, mm. and it's a dense piece of bread. I think as taste started to lighten, I think the cap bread sort of began to phase out because of that. It's in much the same way that when George Leidenheimer first started making bread in the 1890s, he was making heavy, dense German breads.
Yes.
And we're not doing that anymore, really.
I have sometimes heard cap bread described as the Sunday bread. Do you know anything about that? Is that just something crazy I've been told, that a lot of people had that reserved for their Sunday dinner table?
Wouldn't surprise me. Based on the size, you know, a couple of them could probably feed a pretty big Sunday table. So that doesn't surprise me at all. I don't know much about whether bakers only made it on certain days. But again, that is also something that was traditional, certainly in the early 1900s, is that bakers would reserve certain days for making certain loaves.
Well, you all are certainly up on restaurant trends across the country and really the world. So have either of you seen any baking revivals like this happening anywhere else?
Well, I think that what I've seen is a focus on high-quality breads. I think that the old days of throwing anything in a bread basket and thinking that you're going to get it past customers, I think those days are gone in fine dining. In terms of folks who are researching the culinary background of an entire city, there aren't many places you can do that except New Orleans. I mean, what Dickie's doing, of course, is also a function of where he is and where we are and how fortunate we are to be here.
We have such a rich history.
We do. Right. And I'm not saying other parts of the country don't, but they
not
just,
like us.
They can't. They don't, it's not there.
I mean, what you see is a Thomas Keller doing a great baking book, but it's all classic French. It's
yeah.
not California. I think what Sandy's making reference to, this is a New Orleans thing, and through the history, we're able to go back and do it. It's been fun.
Congratulations to you both on this really great project, the beautiful new restaurant. Dickie and Sandy, thank you for finally coming to talk bread with us.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to be here.
Sandy Wan of Leidenheimer Baking Company and Dickie Brennan of Tableau. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, Paul Greenberg demystifies the dead zone and explains why the Gulf of Mexico will experience its largest ever this summer.
The term dead zone really refers to large areas. The larger dead zone that we're worried about right now is off of coastal Louisiana, and that's a direct result of huge amounts of fertilizer coming into the Mississippi, all up and down the main stem of the river, hitting the Mississippi, stimulating the growth of algae, huge blooms happen, huge die-offs happen, and then huge hypoxia happen.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company, Lightseagen and Westside Lightseagen Funeral Homes, LCI Workers' Comp, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Kitchen and Culture Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to producer and sound engineer Thomas Walsh. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.